This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, February 5th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. As the Senate appears poised to acquit the president on articles of impeachment sent over from the House, just what was the point of this? Was it a worthy enterprise? A witch hunt? Was it a waste of time and resources, or even a failed attempt that, by virtue of its failure, will unshackle an erratic president? Cato's Gene Healy, author of the Cato paper Indispensable Remedy, explores these ideas. As of this recording, it looks like the Senate, after having not called any witnesses in the impeachment trial of the president, that they're going to acquit. So in that case, what really was the point of this exercise?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't think acquittal's a surprise to anyone. I don't think we have to strain too hard to explain that outcome. It was always going to be a heavy lift to get 20 Republican senators to cross the aisle, and apparently a heavy lift to get any of them to cross the aisle. But, you know, no president has presidents are infrequently impeached. Donald Trump's only the third. In the two prior Senate trials, you didn't get a conviction either. And the outcome, at least if you believe the recent polls, may be roughly where the public is. Some of the polls that have come out in the last week or so show about even just under half of Americans polled support removal. In the polls that ask, clear majorities disagree with the proposition that it was a quote-unquote perfect call. Most say that the president did something wrong slash abused his power. But while there's more support for the president's removal than you typically see in any presidency, I mean, Nixon didn't get to this point in impeachment polls until the summer of 1974, shortly before he was forced to resign. But there's certainly not a groundswell to remove President Trump in an election year.
With respect to what a lot of people were arguing, Adam Schiff and some Republicans on the other side were arguing that that removing him would set a dangerous precedent. Adam Schiff, of course, arguing the opposite, that not removing him sets a dangerous precedent. What's the value of precedent since we're not really dealing – this isn't really establishing case law in any way?
No, a precedent really needs the scare quotes in impeachment. It's always a little bit hard to – it's harder to discern what the holding of an impeachment is than it is to discern what the holding of a particular Supreme Court case is. So you have to figure out what does acquittal mean in this circumstance, and that's always hard to do. What did acquittal mean in the Clinton impeachment trial? How would you describe the takeaway from that? It wasn't – I don't think you'd say that the message of that acquittal was that fooling around with an intern and lying about it in court is totally okay. It was a perfect fling. It was – the takeaway was doing that is bad. It may lend you in hot water, but the judgment of the Senate and certainly of the public at the time was that it didn't rise to the level that justifies getting rid of the president. Now, in terms of how that plays out for Trump's inevitable acquittal, a lot of that is going to depend on how senators explain their votes to acquit, which they typically do. A lot of them explained it in the Clinton trial 21 years ago. And so that could go a couple of different ways. If they follow the lead of the House, I think that could be bad. The House Republicans, in the dissents to the House Judiciary Committee report, basically took the president's line that the July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian President Zelensky was a perfect call, that president was just neutrally interested in corruption, and just so happened that the corruption he was interested in involved one of his likely 2020 opponents for the presidency. There's some signs that the Senate is going to take a different line in terms of explaining their votes to acquit. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski said the other day that the president's behavior was, quote, shameful and wrong, but that it didn't justify removal, particularly in an election year. And there's some signs from other senators that they're not going to follow the House in endorsing President Trump's theory of his own behavior or endorsing what his defense counsel argued, which was right up to the edge of saying that abuse of power couldn't be an impeachable offense. The Senate looks like Republican senators are going to, at least a few of them are going to condemn President Trump's behavior, but say it doesn't justify his removal. If that's the case, we'll be somewhere in the middle, that using the diplomatic and foreign policy powers of the office in order to damage your political enemy is something that is not good to do and could lend you in a hot mess, but not at this particular juncture removable. And that's a better outcome than what the president's lawyers and the president himself were arguing for, which would essentially be overturning our understanding of the Nixon case. Remember that Nixon quit before the full House could vote, but there were articles of impeachment voted out of the Judiciary Committee against him. And we've long understood that case to mean, among other things, that using the powers of the federal government to screw your political enemies, in John Dean's famous phrase, was a bad thing to do and could end up forcing you out of office. And I don't think that's an understanding or a precedent that we want to damage. I think that sort of behavior is wrong, should be understood to be wrong, and should be understood to carry consequences.
What was then the point of all of this?
Well, you have to, you can't run the counterfactual. There was a danger if the House was too timid to press impeachment that you completely endorse this sort of behavior. There's always a discussion, there's even a discussion right now about congressional censure, one or both houses passing a resolution where they say the president did a really bad thing. Impeachment by the House without conviction in the Senate is essentially constitutional censure. It's the only form of censure that anybody remembers. It leaves a mark. It's in the first paragraph of the Wikipedia entries for the two prior presidents that have been impeached. I'm sure it will be the same in Trump's Wikipedia entry, if it's not already. And it's something that presidents don't like to go through. Even Donald Trump, for whom shamelessness is a bit of a superpower, even he seems wounded by it. Just the other week, he was tweeting about how unfair it was that he had to suffer the quote-unquote stigma of impeachment. So it does perform, even though the bar is set so high that it has proven essentially impossible to remove a president in a Senate trial, impeachment does function, by the House, does function the way that advocates of congressional censure only hope that that sort of remedy functions.
In terms of the reaction, this is, you might think of this as take the president taking an antibiotic. That is, he's cleared out the danger to himself. Will he be then emboldened to double down on this kind of behavior?
Yeah, well, what I just gave you is the happy story about the outcome of this particular, fourth serious effort at impeaching an American president. And there's a much less happy story you can tell, and that's the one you allude to, which we're always kind of writing on a blank slate when it comes to presidential impeachment because there are so few of them. But we're doing that particularly in this case because presidential impeachments have tended to occur when presidents were essentially lame ducks. In the Nixon impeachment effort and the Clinton impeachment, you know, both of those presidents were term limited by the 22nd Amendment. In the Johnson impeachment, there was no way he was going to get the Republican nomination. And if I recall correctly, he tried and failed at the Democratic nomination after his acquittal. So he was essentially a lame duck. This will be the first time when we have a president who survives an impeachment trial and runs for reelection and may very well win reelection. And the theory is that impeachment's a cannon you can fire only once. And, but I guess we're going to test that proposition or if he wins re-election, because it is, given that the outcome of the Mueller investigation, when he was essentially cleared in the Mueller, not cleared of obstruction of justice, but at least of some of the, Russian conspiracy charges, it's the day after Robert Mueller gives this underwhelming testimony before Congress. July 24th is when that's all wrapped up. And it's July 25th. He's on the phone with President Zelensky trying to gin up an investigation into Joe and Hunter Biden. So you could say by the pattern of his past behavior that, the two-year investigation didn't deter him much. Maybe impeachment won't deter him much if he's reelected. We're gonna find out how that goes.
Is it encouraging that this was a president who was impeached in his first term, or does that matter?
Hard to say. I
say that because you're someone who believes that impeachment is something that people shouldn't be afraid of, that Congress specifically shouldn't be afraid of, and that it ought to be trotted out a little more often.
Yes. Well, I think as far as that goes, one of the things that this impeachment effort underscored was how hollow all of these, this parade of horribles that's constantly trotted out on the rare occasions when we're talking seriously about a presidential impeachment. We hear, that it's a national nightmare. Ken Starr quoted that in his trial arguments. He said impeachment is hell. We're told that every time a president is in the dock that we risk economic disruption, a distraction from the vital business of government, and it's going to polarize us so much we'll all be at each other's throats. And so now we've been through this three times in under five decades, if you count Nixon, and none of that turns out to be true, particularly didn't turn out to be true this time around. The stock market boomed in our last two impeachments, including this one, for better or for worse. I think a lot of us would say for worse. Impeachment just doesn't paralyze government. It wasn't true for Nixon. He signed four major bills. After he was the impeachment inquiry opened, Clinton had a similar legislative flurry in the month after his impeachment inquiry was approved. This time around, while Congress was impeaching Trump, it also passed a federal family leave, hiked the tobacco minimum age to 21, and gave a space force. So, maybe we could use a little more paralysis. But all of these scare stories, including the craziest one that seemed to show up mainly in this impeachment effort, we were risking a civil war and mass red on blue violence. All of this turns out to be complete fiction. So in that sense, The costs of impeachment are not what they have been said to be. On the other hand, you could say that this impeachment did reveal a different kind of risk that Congress was taking, particularly in a with a president that's eligible for re-election, which is you wheel out that cannon and you fire it and doesn't do much, or it has a a little flag comes out that says bang on it. Congress has sort of exposed the difficulty of getting this so-called ultimate weapon to work successfully beyond the stigma that attaches to a president who's impeached. It's clearly not a good vehicle for removing a president before his term is up. So, I've seen some solid arguments about, Congress has really revealed that it is a weak hand vis-a-vis the executive by wheeling out this cannon and having it sort of splutter. And I think that's something that's a cost we have to take seriously.
What do you make of the claim from Catherine Mangu Ward? She's the editor of Reason Magazine, that impeachment is not about sort of maintaining a standard for a president. It is about wresting powers from an individual person. And if that's really what it's all about, then it's just a big distraction and we should be focusing on the size and scope of government.
Well, I think we should be focusing on the size and scope of government and the concentration of power in the executive branch. And we have at least one experience with presidential impeachment where impeachment aided that effort, sort of concentrated the focus. The clearest case of that is the Nixon case. The congressional reformers of the 70s in the Watergate era and post-Watergate era didn't just stop with hunting down Nixon and trying to force him from office. They pushed for legislation on a number of fronts that was designed to make it harder for a future Nixon or a future LBJ to abuse presidential power. And that's really the last time in the 1970s, in the post-Watergate Congresses, that we see a serious effort at restoring the separation of powers. You had the passage of the Impoundment Act, which you may have heard of when on the road to Trump's impeachment, he violated that act. Congress trying to reclaim the power of the purse. They strengthened the Freedom of Information Act, passed the War Powers Resolution, the Inspector General Act, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Now, none of this stuff worked perfectly, but it's our last serious reform effort, and some of it worked well enough for a time. So the Nixon effort was a case where impeachment was a catalyst towards a broader effort at structural reforms to de-imperialize the presidency. I'd like to say that's going to happen now, but there's certainly no guarantee of that, and probably not going to lose money betting against a congressional outbreak of profiles and courage. But I will say that for as long as I've been following these issues, which is pretty long now, there's more movement on the Hill and more interest and more creative, legislative attempts to put the imperial presidency back in its box than I've seen in decades. It's an uphill battle, and I'd like to say that I would like to see a situation where impeachment has sort of concentrated the mind on the powers that we've let the executive branch accumulate, and I'd like to see a renewed reform effort in that direction. So I think that's where our attention should be now.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute and author of the Cato paper, Indispensable Remedy. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please and follow us on Twitter @Cato Podcast.